I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today to jumpstart giving to help close a $94,000 funding gap before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of listeners like you to bring you this podcast and so many other resources to strengthen your faith. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to help close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/unbelievable. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievable. Thank you.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And our topic today was inspired by an excellent article I read from the AP news agency in the United States. And it's headlined this, "A Crisis of Conscience Spurred This Christian IVF Doctor's Career Pivot." And it's this kind of in-depth profile of a doctor called John Gordon, who's a reproductive endocrinologist and has basically been working in fertility treatment for decades, running an IVF clinic effectively. But then over time, it tells a story about how he started to kind of reimagine the ethics of IVF and fertility treatment as a Christian, and came to believe that the way he'd been doing it was wrong, in particularly around the issue of surplus embryos and what you do with them. And this eventually led him in 2018 to buy his own clinic and set it up as a kind of specifically Christian clinic, which does IVF in a very different way, seeking to produce no surplus embryos, do no genetic testing, do not donate embryos to science, which I thought was a really fascinating personal story, but also kind of sheds light on what I know is quite a kind of pressing pastoral question for a lot of Christians.
Yeah, it's a really interesting article about a Christian doctor who is highly successful because, in fact, IVF specialists and fertility specialists are some of the highest earning doctors in the US and across the world. There's a massive industry, and it's a very commercially effective industry, and then being beset by doubts and concerns. And there's this interesting bit where it's in the article, it says in 2018, his wife pushed him to change. They both believed in the sanctity of embryos as part of their Christian faith. But as Alison Gordon looked around the home where they'd raised four children, their comfortable life now seemed bought by ill-gotten gains. Mm. And, I really recognize those moral dilemmas that I think Christian doctors often face, where they feel pressurized by the system into doing things which they feel morally dubious. It's not completely black and white, but they feel uneasy and concerned about it. And then what do you do with those feelings? Do you just push it down and say, well, I've just got to carry on doing my job? Or are you prepared, as this man was, to make really very dramatic changes? Mm. And it's a question of conscience, and I think that in itself is an interesting issue. That as Christians, conscience is an incredibly important concept. That the voice, a moral voice within one, which is raising questions about the way you're spending your time, the way you're earning your money, and a fundamental rule, I think, is that if we go against our deeply held conscience concerns, then it becomes something that is morally destructive. Mm. And in the end, we have to obey our conscience, even if it has professional consequences.
Yes. And I think what I found interesting on a kind of personal level about this story as well is the idea that, as you say, this guy, Gordon, had kind of gone into fertility treatment with great intentions. You know, it says that he wanted to use his medical skills to help people. And, like, I think, you know, it's hugely admirable. You know, people experiencing infertility have experienced great pain often, and it's incredibly, you know, profoundly Christian to seek to want to kind of serve and care for people as best you can and use our technological skill to help people. And yet he developed these nagging doubts, I guess. Oh, it's, as you say, it's easy to get sucked into the system, a system that isn't necessarily built on entirely Christian foundations in many parts of medicine and in other careers as well. I think, I'm sure this is true in the law and in the military and in business. People go into these things with great intentions, and then you kind of wake up 20 years later and you think, hang on, how did I get here? Somehow I've drifted without ever really noticing. And what I really admire about this guy, Gordon, whether or not you agree with his convictions, and we'll get into that in a minute, but I admire the fact that he didn't just push that still small voice down and just crack on making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year doing standard IVF treatment. But he actually had the courage to listen to that conscience and then take, as we'll discover, quite a costly step to try and respond and do something different to it. Whereas I guess a lot of Christians would find it quite difficult to take that courageous step of faith, and it would be the path of least resistance is just to kind of push this to one side and try not to think about it too much.
Yeah, and absolutely right. And I think we're all guilty of that, of wanting to silence that nagging question and doubt. And particularly when either professional status or money is involved, it takes significant courage to go that step. So I think, you know, before we dive into more of the details, I think we probably ought to just say that we recognise that this is a deeply sensitive topic. We're talking about infertility, about the desperate longing of couples to have children, and who feel sometimes driven to technological extremes out of this longing to have children. And these are, I mean, right from the beginning, I think it's important to recognise the pain of infertility, which affects so many people.
Mm. About one in seven couples, I think the average is.
That's right, and of course, what that means is that many people go into marriage not knowing that actually they're going to have extreme difficulty in having a child, and often never having discussed it. You know, years ago, when we used to do marriage preparation at our church in London, it was one of the things, inevitably because of my background, we used to get couples to talk. You know, what would you do if you discovered you were infertile? What decisions would you make? Mm. And because you need to have talked about these things before, you know, if you suddenly discover that you have some absolutely catastrophic difference of opinion, if you were faced as a couple with infertility, that could be extremely damaging to the relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think is worth, we want to stay up front before we get into it, is that these are really complex issues. There aren't any kind of easy proof text Bible verses you can just read and say all Christians should believe X or do Y. Christians in good faith will disagree about some of the ethics of these issues. And we don't want to come across as though we're kind of denouncing anyone's decision, condemning anyone for decisions they have or haven't made in the past, or suggesting that we have solved this problem and that we've wrapped this up neatly in a bow. We're really wanting to open up this issue and talk about it because we know it is a significant one, but we're not going to pretend that we have all the answers or that everyone must necessarily always agree with where we might land on some of these really challenging and difficult questions.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that I know from many conversations with couples with difficulty with fertility is how often people feel that the Christian church is incredibly insensitive on this topic. Christian churches, particularly maybe evangelical Protestant churches, put a a great emphasis on families, young families, Mothering Sunday, and you celebrate the arrival of babies. And there's such a huge sort of pro-child, pro-family move that the fact that they're sitting in that congregation while we're all celebrating Mothering Sunday, people who desperately, desperately long to be a mother and that it didn't happen, and that this is never acknowledged, or, you know, that this might be painful for some people, and, you know, and I think that's a big issue which pastors and church leaders often just ignore.
Yeah, definitely. And we don't, as I said, we don't want anyone to feel judged or condemned or more excluded or isolated. I think it's critical that the church learns to how to have sensitive, compassionate conversations about this rather than either ignoring it entirely or kind of jumping to kind of simplistic preaching from the pulpit. So all that said, shall we talk a bit more about John Gordon, the doctor at the heart of this story? We should say there's a link to this story you can read for yourself if you'd like, which is in the show notes.
Yeah, so I think what's clear is that John Gordon was working in a fertility clinic in suburban Washington, D.C., and therefore was providing the sort of standard IVF services which fertility clinics around the world provide. And just as a side note, it's important to understand that fertility treatments are not something that are confined to the rich developed world, but in fact, in most low-resource countries across the world, including in some of the poorest countries in the world, you will find fertility clinics practicing expensive Western medicine. this is a global industry, and so it's not just a rich world issue.
The longing for children is a universal human experience, isn't it, fundamentally?
And this is the reason why fertility specialists are so well paid, is that if push comes to shove, many couples are prepared to live in penury and to mortgage, if they've got a house, to mortgage it, or, you know, to give all their life savings, or to sell the cow, or whatever it is, just for the possibility of having a child. Particularly true, I understand, that in many cultures, African cultures, Asian cultures, infertility is not only a personal pain, internal pain, it's actually a huge social stigma. Mm. I mean, particularly for the woman, you know, most very unfairly, since a lot of infertility is actually medically comes to the down to the man. Mm. It's the woman who is regarded as substandard and as a failure in many cultures. So it's not surprising, therefore, that sometimes desperate attempts to get a child and use Western technology. So just the standard IVF process would be rule out basic issues, make sure that the husband is producing fertile sperm and that the wife or the woman is producing eggs, and then the woman is usually given endocrine stimulants to make her hyperovulate, that is, to produce a large number of eggs rather than the normal process, which is to produce one egg in each monthly cycle. Sometimes as many as 15, 20, 25 eggs are produced, which is a grossly unphysiological thing that happens when you just give large amounts of hormones to stimulate the ovaries. Then what happens is the embryos are harvested.
The eggs.
Quotes.
Not embryos. Sorry,
the eggs
point.
Are harvested, yeah. Eggs are harvested, put in a... and allowed to grow. They're mixed with the sperm first, and then the embryos are allowed to grow. They're examined under a microscope. And in the UK, normally the best two embryos are then selected and reinserted back into the uterus at the right time of the cycle, so they have the best chance of becoming implanted. And then, of course, you've got a problem. What do we do with what could easily be 10, 15 or more surplus embryos?
Exactly. And so this was what Gordon, in his physical clinic, his kind of classic clinic in Washington, was kind of growing troubling over, was what's sometimes called the problem of surplus embryos. So when you do a cycle of IVF, as you say, it's very normal, standard for the couple to complete that cycle and have dozens potentially of embryos in frozen in storage, and those embryos can basically be frozen, as far as we know, kind of indefinitely. They're only a few days old, but you can basically pause life in deep freeze, and as long as you keep the power running and the liquid nitrogen flowing, they can just sit there for decade upon decade.
Yeah, well, in fact, you've got several options. So one is freezing, which sort of often people opt for because it kind of kicks the can down the road. Yeah. I don't need to make a hard decision. Another option is to donate the spare embryos to another couple who are desperate to have a child, and are by donating the embryo, I'm helping them to have a child. Another option is to donate the embryos for medical research, which is destructive research. The embryos will effectively be pulled apart in order to obtain stem cells and do other research procedures. Or finally, to discard the embryos and literally throw them away. And many people confronted with those options can say, well, I'm really troubled by this, and I'm troubled by embryo adoption, and I'm troubled by medical research, and I don't want to throw them away. Let's put them in the deep freeze.
Mm. And the second thing that Gordon and his wife were kind of concerned about was also, over his career, the ability to genetically test the embryos. So as well as looking at them under a microscope and just observing which ones seem to be growing the healthiest, you can also now, it's increasingly available and affordable to do some kind of genetic test and examine the DNA of your potential children. And as we've discussed in previous episodes, this is what is effectively creating a kind of market for the kind of return of liberal eugenics, as it's sometimes called, where parents have the ability to choose things in some, depending on your country and your laws and your systems. Sometimes you can choose things like the sex of your child, but also you could try to screen out embryos that carry genes which might lead to causing various kinds of disabilities or illnesses in the future. And in theory, some people claim you could even start to select for things like intelligence or sporting aptitude. And this kind of genetic testing, even at its more kind of basic level of just trying to screen out diseases, was also starting to trouble Gordon, who was a kind of reformed evangelical Christian and believed kind of quite strongly in the idea of the sovereignty of God, and the idea that God should have control over which children kind of grow up, not humans.
Yeah, that's right. So so-called pre-implantation genetic screening, genetic diagnosis. I mean, it started only to be for a very specific use, which was where families had a previous child with a genetic disorder, and they like cystic fibrosis, and now they wanted to have a second child, but they wanted to make sure that this second child didn't have cystic fibrosis. The idea then that we could create a lot of embryos, we could do pre-implantation genetic testing of these embryos and then select the embryos that we knew didn't have cystic fibrosis. And and it has been argued that using this technology, many, many thousands of children have been born who didn't have a potential devastating genetic condition. I think the argument goes that that's a positive use of this screening technology. But of course it does contain already this selective process, choosing who will live and who won't live, a kind of quality control. So wherever we have technology, we have to have quality control. You have to try and monitor the output. You are using all this technology. And it's interesting that, having had discussions over the years with fertility specialists, many of them see this as the ultimate tragedy, to use all this high-tech stuff to then create a baby who then has an avoidable condition. they see that as an absolute tragedy. They're far better not to use the technology at all than to use the technology to create a child who then has some kind of disability. So this is the kind of quality control mentality, isn't it? You know,
you've mechanized childbirth. It's like a factory, isn't it?
And to create, to use all this expensive technology, and the parents have gone through this whole process, and we end up with what, sadly, was it, they would say is a dud, you know, is a terrible disaster.
Mm. And in some way, this echoes conversations people have around testing later on. So for example, you know, we've talked previously about non-invasive prenatal testing, which can now identify conditions like Down syndrome. You sometimes hear this described as, well, this is amazing, we can effectively eradicate Down syndrome, but what that actually means is every time we detect a child growing in the womb who has Down syndrome, the mother is recommended to have an abortion. But it doesn't change at all how many embryos carry that genetic abnormality that causes Down syndrome. They continue happening, randomly mutating. And in the same way, this cystic fibrosis example, it doesn't actually prevent any cases of cystic fibrosis. It just means that we can catch them so early and we just choose not to implant those embryos. It's another version of that where it looks like you're solving a problem, but actually all you're really doing is just parking the problem, because you're not actually able to... The real victory, I would argue, would be to prevent cystic fibrosis from developing in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Technically, in the world of preventative medicine, there's primary preventing, which is preventing the disease happening in the first place. And there's secondary prevention, which is intervening to stop the consequences. And this is kind of secondary prevention. You're not stopping the condition in the first place, but you are intervening, making an intervention to make sure that the child doesn't get born.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So obviously behind all this is one of the issues which is so contested and troubling, which is, what is the status?
Yeah.
You know, how do we think about these beings when we've created 20 of them in a test tube? You know, how do we think of them?
Yeah.
Because the standard fertility specialist's view, the standard embryologist view, is to say, well, look, you know, I look under the microscope and I see a bunch of cells, and they look just the same as any other bunch of cells, and I know that what they consist of, and I understand what the mechanics of it is, and here is the nucleus, and here is the intracellular mechanism, and here's the bilipid membrane around the outside. So why are you getting so excited? Why are you so traumatized about this? Is just a cell.
Mm. Yes, exactly. And then on the other end, you have Christians who feel very strongly, often landing there from the abortion debates, that we have to hold the line that from the moment the sperm meets the egg, this is a human being made in God's image of equal dignity and status and rights as you or I. And therefore, there are some conservative Christians who look at IVF and say, what you are fundamentally doing is creating 30 human beings, choosing two that get to live and killing 28, or freezing 28 and leaving them languishing in cold storage for 50 years.
Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is, generous friends of the ministry have offered to match the first $5,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. That's premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Absolutely. And I think these are deep and troubling and important questions, and ones which I've been wrestling with personally for a good 30 years, I should think. I'm wondering whether we should put these on one side as being sort of major philosophical, theological questions, and continue the story and to see this particular fertility doctor's response.
Yes. Maybe we'll come back in a subsequent episode to try and tackle some of those macro questions. But yeah, so John Gordon, he decides, as we said before, in 2018, that he can no longer in conscience carry on doing kind of traditional IVF. And so he buys his own practice in Tennessee and decides, which he calls Rejoice Fertility, and decides to try and do IVF differently. So Rejoice Fertility does not discard viable embryos, genetically test them, or donate them to science. And it also imposes limits on how many embryos each couple can create in that cycle. The article goes on to paint this picture of fertility clinic. You know, it's got Bible verses in the recovery room, and there are crosses everywhere, and he prays with people before he leads implantation, and it's got a particular, almost a kind of a ministry. It's a business, but you know, people come from very far away, Christians who are trying to thread that needle, that we are experiencing infertility, we'd like to do IVF, but we're troubled by the traditional way, and Rejoice Fertility seems to kind of split the difference, to offer a way of doing IVF that doesn't raise all those troubling concerns about surplus embryos and genetic testing.
So this particular Christian doctor then decided that he would carry on using IVF, but they would never discard embryos, they wouldn't test them, and they wouldn't discard them, and effectively that meant that they had to find ways of storing large numbers of excess embryos, their clinic's approach, as far as I can see, is that they will accept almost any embryo, no matter its condition. Sometimes the ugliest embryos make the prettiest babies. And when a couple received a donated embryo that had been frozen for nearly 31 years, Rejoice provided their care. And that they broke what was believed to be the record for the longest frozen embryo to result in a birth.
Mm. The downside, as the article explains, is that because the reason why classic IVF has led to this kind of hyperovulation approach is that it's a more, if you're solely focused on producing at least one healthy implanted child, this is a more efficient approach. Whereas Gordon's method, where you produce each IVF cycle has lower amounts of fertility medication and results in fewer eggs. Means that you're less likely for it to succeed, and so you're more likely to have to do multiple cycles. And given that an IVF cycle can cost tens of thousands of dollars, this is, if you choose to go down this kind of no discard IVF route, you are doing so knowing that it's going to be less likely to succeed and cost you more money and potentially take much longer.
Yes, so There are various options here. One option is not to use any kind of hormonal hyperovulation, which means that the woman will only produce one egg in each cycle, as opposed to many, and then to choose to fertilize that one egg and then to reimplant the one egg, whatever the condition of the embryo. And this is an option which actually is available in the UK. It would be perfectly possible for a couple who are considering IVF to specifically request this option and discuss it with a fertility clinic. Many fertility clinics provide it as an option, but they are reluctant to do it because they know that the success rates are very much significantly lower, and there's a huge competition between fertility clinics and their success rates, which also affects their commercial standing. So again, these things have unintended consequences, but certainly I think that this is an option for people who are very concerned about embryos. an alternative is to say that we will only select two or three eggs and fertilize those and then put those back. Yes, we would use some degree of hyperovulation, but instead of harvesting a large number of eggs, we will only harvest two or three eggs. So that's another option which avoids the problem of surplus and discarded embryos.
Yeah. And I think what I find interesting is reading some of the quotes from the patients who use Rejoice. There's one here called Emily Martin, who had previously done IVF at another clinic. And it says that she's haunted by the handful of embryos that she does have in storage. Quote, I would wake up in the middle of the night just like, oh, what have we done? And just this heaviness. She says she herself is anti-abortion and she wishes she had found Rejoice before making more embryos than she could use at another clinic. And in rare cases, when even at Rejoice there are leftover embryos, Gordon, this doctor, asked for them to be placed for adoption. So this is, as we said, this is when you can donate your embryos to another couple. So rather than they go through the process of hyperovulation and selection and all that stuff, they just take a kind of pre-made embryo from someone else. So the child that you eventually carry won't be genetically related to you, even though they grew in your womb and you gave birth to them.
Yes, and this problem about having spare embryos is actually not that unusual, you know, because many, many people have gone through IVF and without really thinking through the implications have put frozen embryos in storage. And then, you know, they're left with this challenging question, what on earth should we do? And I spoke to a pastor not long ago who contacted me because someone within their church was in this very situation and was asking for advice about, you know, how do I handle this partially? What should my advice be? And is embryo adoption a good option? But some people feel very uneasy about the implications of a child who is genetically theirs growing up somewhere else and not having any kind of knowledge or contact with what is happening to that child.
Yeah, it's certainly fraught, as all adoption is, as we've discussed in this podcast before. It's a fraught question that raises lots of challenging things around identity, families, and I think it's important to note that embryo adoption doesn't kind of resolve all of those just because the child grows in your womb. Like, it's clearly less of a rupture than traditional adoption might involve. But still, we shouldn't underestimate that when children grow up to learn that they have another biological mother and father somewhere else in the world. Sometimes this can take place over borders. So your biological mother and father might be many tens of thousands of miles away. They might be known to you. They might be unknown. They might be traceable, not untraceable. These things, it carries a weight for the adopted child to wrestle with. And so I think it's important. I think embryo adoption could sometimes be quite a redemptive act if you're trying to kind of liberate embryos from languishing in cold storage, but we shouldn't pretend or delude ourselves that it's kind of easy or simple just because it's less of a rupture and a move than ordinary adoption.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think one of the interesting and sad pieces of information which comes out is that although the recommendations are that whenever a baby is born either by embryo adoption or by donor gametes, by donor eggs and sperm, the recommendations from the authorities is that right from the earliest moment, this should be explained to the child, you know, and the process explained to them and discussed. So the child never remembers
not knowing,
discovering this. It was always something they knew. In reality, unlike actual physical adoption, many parents don't tell the children about their genetic origins. And it's often a sort of kind of guilty secret, which gradually the child is sort of adolescence and beyond starts to work out, you know, why do I not look anything like my parents? You know, how can that be? You know, why is my skin color different? Why am I, you know, and was my mother, you know, having an adulterous relationship? Was it, what was going on? And eventually children sometimes work it out, or sometimes I've heard even on their deathbed, a parent, you know, says, there's something I need to tell you.
Yeah. And we've, as we discussed before, sometimes children have no idea and live in blissful ignorance, and parents think, gosh, that worked out so well. What they didn't predict was the growth of Ancestry.com and 23andMe and at-home DNA testing. And you spit into your tube as a fun party game to find out what percentage you're Native American you are, and you actually discover, you put it into the database, tells you have a half sister who lives on the other side of the country, and that raises some challenging questions to your parents. And so, it is tempting, I think, often to not tell your children, but it is always a bad idea.
And this is very important to understand. This is, again, it's a topic we've mentioned before, isn't it? That DNA and genetics is very different from donating other, you know, when I donate a kidney. That has nothing like the same implications. But when I donate a sperm, an egg, or an embryo, I am donating something that is actually very, very deeply related to who I am. And also to my family tree, my inheritance, my roots, all that stuff, which of course is a deep and part of our humanity.
Yes. So just coming back to Rejoice Fertility and Gordon, some people might come across and say, this is wonderful. This is kind of squaring the impossible circle. It's a way of using the benefits of our knowledge of fertility and how human reproduction works and all that we've gained over the last 50 years, but using that technology to give children to childless couples without creating potentially dozens of future human beings without having to go down the messy road of genetic testing, destruction, donation, research. Isn't this a brilliant thing? Shouldn't we be encouraging more Christian IVF doctors to pursue what Gordon has done?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I mean, I do think it is admirable that he clearly, followed his conscience and paid a price financially, but also apparently had then legal...
Yes.
Suits from the doctor who previously owned the clinic and so on. So, you know, there are all kinds of knock-on effects here. I mean, having said that, there are still deep, deep concerns about IVF, quite apart from the problems of surplus embryos, you know, from a Christian point of view. One is that the only reason that IVF has become relatively successful, with a kind of success rate which varies, but it's sort of 1 in 3, 2 out of 5, something like that, for each cycle, depending on lots of different factors. The only reason it's so successful is because millions upon millions upon millions of embryos have been destroyed in the process of research going back 50 years. And so the question comes, well, how do I think about that? Yes, I'm not actually personally involved in destroying an embryo, but I'm building on research, much of which I feel deeply uncomfortable about. And interestingly, this is a deep, deep and challenging issue in medical research. Quite a lot of the things that we now use in medicine have come from research which was carried out under pretty unethical circumstances. And so does that mean that we can't possibly use any of this knowledge because we think it's ethically contaminated?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of those debates we had around the COVID vaccine, and when it became clear that some COVID vaccines had been, in their development, had been tested on human cell lines that had potentially, we're not entirely clear, but may have ultimately the progenitor of those cell lines was from an aborted fetus. And it raises those questions about your proximity to something that you consider to be unethical or immoral or even sinful. How close or how far away does it before it becomes too close? You know, clearly we live in a broken, fallen world, and all of our actions are bound up in a complex web of cause and effect with sin and fallenness. But as you say, for some Christians, maybe the idea of utilizing a technique that resulted in the destruction of so many embryos in the past, even if you can do it right, might be too far. I mean, some other people have issues around IVF separate from the idea of embryos, but also on the idea of the kind of sovereignty of God argument, that it's meddling and exercising kind of idolatrous human control over something that should be mysterious and left to God. I mean, the Catholic Church, for example, opposes IVF not just on the grounds of creating surplus embryos, but because they don't believe that human beings should be messing around with that in any sense.
Yes, that's right. And of course, the same applies to contraception. And again, a complex and difficult topic. And I think there's definitely something in that argument, the argument that in God's design, you know, in creation design, if you believe that there is a creation order and that order is good, the fundamental way in which God made human beings, then part of that creation order is that we should not be able to control which and what kind of babies are produced, and that, you know, when you're trying to make a baby, it is an act of faith, hope and love. You have no idea what might happen and who might happen. And the argument goes that's the way it was meant to be, and that a sort of robust trust in God's sovereignty is best. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you could say that means that any kind of fertility intervention is inappropriate. You know, I trust God, and if we don't have a baby, then that means I accept it. But that seems to sit uneasily with modern medicine, with the fact that God has allowed us to understand how the body works and to use that knowledge wisely and so on. So again, these are matters of degree. Mm. And I think there's one other issue which does concern me about IVF, and that is it is extraordinarily invasive and technologically dominating. And I know for many couples who go through IVF circles find it a very, very psychologically stressful, and again, often don't really reckon with quite how invasive it is, because of course you're dealing with the most intimate and painful and sensitive parts of your... I sometimes, to sort of dramatise it, I think it's as though you've got a couple in bed making love, and all of a sudden the lights go on and a whole series of white-coated professionals come into the room and say, right, okay, now we need to get a sperm sample from here. And and this, what should be this intimate and private experience, is now suddenly exposed to these professionals. And what worries me sometimes is it turns out that one part of the couple is desperate to do this, and the other one is much less keen. And then that can create some tensions, actually, in the relationship.
Mm. Yes. And I think, as we've discussed before, kind of technology, once you know you have the ability to do something, it becomes challenging almost not to do it. And I think in previous eras, before the invention and the kind of popularity of IVF, there was... You know, infertility was always devastating to deal with. You can see that in scripture, you know, the pain it causes people who are unable to have children. But at least these couples weren't faced with, well, you could always do IVF. And there's this kind of societal presumption that, oh, we've kind of solved that infertility problem. You know, we've harnessed the power of science, and we basically, you just go and you do IVF, you pay your money, and you cycle through times until it eventually works and everything is fine. which somewhat glosses over the costs and the deep thought that is required to enter into this process. I think sometimes people just feel they're kind of ushered into it. Hey, oh, you have infertility, therefore output is you go to the IVF clinic. And in fact, that's how often some doctors will approach it. You know, you'll go to saying we're struggling to conceive, and you know, after some tepid investigation, they'll just usher you on to the IVF clinic for kind of professional and frankly commercial reasons.
That's right. And I think, therefore, one approach which I very much support in theory is a natural technology approach, using the best medical advice and investigations to try and understand what the cause of the infertility is, and then finding ways to maximise this individual's couple's chance of being able to have a child naturally. That seems to me so much more obvious as a way forward of going alongside the creation order, trying to maximise the creation of the part rather than doing something that is very, very artificial. But sadly, I think for a large reason, because it's not commercially viable, or it has no great profits, this kind of natural fertility medicine is very unusual. There are a few private clinics that do it, in the UK, but it's not something that's become at all common.
Mm. Do you think there would be a market? I mean, clearly in America there is a large constituency of conservative Christians, particularly those who are very pro-life on the abortion issue, who are kind of concerned around IVF. And there are some, you know, Protestant denominations like the Southern Baptists who have kind of passed resolutions expressing their concerns about surplus embryos. So it's kind of gone mainstream, and clearly Gordon can make a living out of his very specialist clinic. Do you think it would ever work in this country? Do you think there would ever be enough demand for kind of no-discard Christian so-called ethical IVF that any clinic could make a go of it here? Or are there just not enough couples looking for that?
I doubt whether a specialist clinic, I think in the British medical system, it would be hard to reproduce that. But I do think, as I've said, that clinics are responding to the fact that more people are coming and saying, we don't want to create surplus embryos. You know, can we explore the options? And interestingly, if you go onto the official government website of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, it does discuss these different options. So it's something that Britain wants to be sensitive to the fact that there are many, it's not just Christians, no. You know, there are many people from other faiths who would have similar concerns about the technology. And so I think there is a greater awareness. I think it comes back to this question of education, doesn't it? You know, I'm surprised at how little these issues are discussed amongst Christian circles. You know, the time to have this discussion is before you're trying to have a baby, isn't it? You don't want to start having this discussion when you've already gone through IVF.
Yeah, and that's the tragedy, is that some Christians, and I've come across Christians before, who never thought about it until they're, as I quoted that woman in the article, they already have 20 embryos in ice. And at that point, it's too late. You can't undo those embryos. And now you're left with the kind of unpalatable choices that we talked about earlier about keep them indefinitely, kick the can down the road, destroy them, donate them, research. And if none of those options appeal to you, you know, where are you left? Just constantly keep trying to reimplant them and have turn as many of them into children as possible. You know, as you say, the critical thing is for people to have these conversations and to think through all the various kind of branching outcomes that IVF is before you pull the trigger and sign the check and actually begin the cycle.
Absolutely. So we'll put in the show notes some more resources and information that we're aware of. There are previous episodes of our podcast where some of these issues have been raised.
Yes. And in the next episode, we're going to kind of zoom out a bit more and talk more generally, not just about ethical, no-discard IVF, but kind of fertility treatment and reproduction technologies in general, and some kind of Christian thoughts and responses to that. So look out for that in the coming weeks. But as Dad said, thanks for listening. There's lots and lots of medical ethics content on Dad's website if you'd like to read and listen to some of that. That's John Wyatt, johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my own journalism and reporting on my website. That's tswyatt.com. And in particular, you can find a link there to sign up to my free weekly church news newsletter, which is called The Critical Friend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.